Welcome to Authenticate This, the cybersecurity leadership podcast for CISOs and identity leaders navigating the complex world of identity. From real-life breaches to internal missteps and everything in between, we bring you authentic stories, hard-earned lessons, and actionable insights to help you lead with confidence when chaos strikes. Our goal is to humanize identity, uncover actionable solutions, and explore the business of identity beyond the spreadsheet. This is Authenticate This, where identity meets leadership. Welcome to Authenticate This, the podcast where we focus on humanizing identity. I'm your host, Tim York, and I've got our host, Jackie Henrich, here as part of our new teams. We have a really awesome guest today. I'm so excited to interview Suzanne Senoff. Suzanne's the CISO at PROS. She's been there for a couple of years. Previously, she was the deputy CISO at McAfee. We're going to jump into Suzanne's career and story and how she works from a human side. But before, I have a couple of fun facts about Suzanne. Well, Suzanne lives in Austin, which is very fitting because one of the things that she loves to do is watch live music. So Suzanne, before we jump in and start talking, we're going to put you on the spot. And this is a Jackie question. What was your first concert and what was your favorite concert?
Okay, so my first concert, I was 8 or 10, and I can't remember if it was Barry Manilow or Neil Diamond at the stadium in Denver, but it was one of those. And my favorite concert was Pink. I saw Pink, gosh, when was it? I think it was like 2014 or something like that, 2015. Amazing. Oh my gosh, and she was pregnant at the time, too. And I was looking at her, I'm like, you are my hero.
Yeah, she's an athlete. Be able to sing and dance and fly around and do all of that. Wow.
Yeah.
One other fun fact about you, Suzanne, and this one was a little bit of a shocker, not total shocker, but a little bit of a shocker, sci-fi books.
Yes, totally.
Where did that come from?
I blame my mother because, you know, you should always blame your mother. So she used to take me to the library when I was a kid and we'd pick out books. And somehow I got onto Piers Anthony and I read his whole series. I can't even remember the name of the series, but it was like 36 books. Read it like 4 or 5 times all the way through. And what I loved about sci-fi was that it really challenged the way you thought about the world. And so everything that I thought was normal, because you know, you're a kid, it's like, you don't know any different. It's like, this is the way it is. And it was like, no, it doesn't have to be that way.
Very cool. Okay, so that's what you learned and that's how it started as a kid. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite sci-fi series or sci-fi book?
My favorite sci-fi book is Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. And I love that book because I read it when I was 15 or 16. I think it was actually assigned to me in a class. It was one of those like, oh my God moments. It's like it was like page 50 and you discover that literally there's an explanation for everything that's wrong in the world.
World problems. I love it. Well, we're not trying to solve the world problems here, but we are trying to solve the human side of identity here. And that goes to our third fun fact. And we're going to talk about this during the interview, but one of the things that stood out on your profile was that you like to make security fun and make identity fun. Tell us about that.
So people say that work isn't supposed to be fun. And they say that's why they call it work. And I don't agree. We spend so much time with it. It's like we should be enjoying ourselves. We should enjoy each other. And you can find fun anywhere. And so we, on our team, we actively try to laugh. And look, let's be real securities. It can be traumatizing in certain ways, right? And so if you don't laugh, you're going to cry. But when we're all laughing together, it can be amazing. We've been sending around security dad jokes. And they're just fun. Security dad jokes. It's like if you look on the internet for security dad jokes, they're so bad. It's so good. Part of making it fun, too, is just giving people the psychological safety to be goofy and to be themselves and to feel like it creates a team where you feel like you're in it together. Because I find that like a lot of what burns people out is this feeling like I'm doing this all by myself. I don't have the support I need. And all of us have bad days sometimes, or we're getting shot at by stakeholders or threat actors, whatever it is.
Yeah. I love what you said, giving safety mm-hmm. to be authentic and to be real. And it's like, if you're goofy and weird, that's okay, because we want you to be real. I love how you said you give permission to laugh and you think everyone should laugh. My favorite moments of all time, whether it's watching a show or a movie or being in a group, or when someone is trying not to laugh, from an inappropriate timing, you're like, me and Jackie can make eye contact in a meeting that's really important, and she does a face where I'm trying not to laugh. That to me is like the most authentic moment. You know, when you're watching Saturday Night Live and they're busting up and they can't do the skit because they're laughing, that's real and it's authentic, and those moments. And so for me, laughter is the thing you can't fake. I mean, you can't fake laughter. And if you allow people to laugh and give people safety to be authentic, we could do a whole podcast just on that. We won't dig in too much on that. But in order to keep things moving along, we'd love to do a quick intro with Jackie. So Jackie is one of our hosts. This is actually her first time hosting this podcast. She's done others before, but she's going to be one of our hosts moving forward here. And I want to tell a quick story about Jackie. So the first time that I met Jackie live, I've met Jackie over video calls just like this many times. And we had started to develop a relationship, and I could tell very quickly she's authentic and real, and I'm naturally drawn to that. We were doing an event in Mexico, and I get off my airplane and I'm getting my baggage and going through, and I hear, Timmy. And I look over and Jackie's got her arms out, and we're both sweaty because we're on the planes and it's humid and hot in Mexico. And we just give each other this big hug, and it felt like I knew you forever, right? And I think one of Jackie's skill sets is connection. And one of the things that she does really well is connect with others. And our roles, it's super, super important that we connect with our partners and our customers and the people from an authentic way to be very, very effective. And so that's Jackie's skill set, and I get to witness it and watch it. I saw the two of you connect yesterday when we were chatting. You're going to be best friends. And I saw when you said Neil Diamond might have been your first concert, was one or the other, I saw Jackie's eyes light up. She's going to want to talk to you about Neil Diamond. I could tell. Thank you, Jack, for being a host here. I'm going to have you do some of this interview, lots of this interview, but we are going to jump into Not the Onion. It seems like a fun segment that all of our audience seem to enjoy. And so for those who are listening to this for the first time, The Onion is a spoof newspaper that creates random articles that sound like they could potentially be real, but they're not. And it's usually just a spoof mocking modern culture, whatever. There's a subreddit in Reddit called Not the Onion, and they take articles from all over the world that should be Onion, but they're not. And so these are actual real articles that I pulled. We don't have to go through them and read them. I just want to read the titles and we can chat through them because this is interesting. So the first one that I pulled up is a Czech fake dentist gave root canal after reading online instructions. So I dig into this article, and there was a whole dentist studio and they were doing a lot of minor dental surgeries, but you know, root canal, I don't know if that's a major dental surgery, but I kind of want someone doing my root canal to be a dentist. And so
even a minor surgery, I would actually want a real dentist too, Tim.
You have some type of credentials if you're going to even clean our teeth or floss our teeth. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that. Obviously, when you go to a dentist office, you don't typically think to check their credentials, but maybe we should.
My first thought was, we didn't verify those credentials. This is a huge authentication failure.
I was starting to wonder if it was an AI hallucination for the online instructions.
The internet makes us all professionals at everything, though.
Totally.
You're a doctor. You're great. We're all set.
All right. So the next article is, this one is hilarious. So Not the Onion, it's the article title is this: AI company files for bankruptcy after being exposed as 700 Indian engineers. And so as I dug into this article, it's really interesting. There was this company that was pretending to be AI, but they actually had real humans behind the scenes doing the work. And their evaluation was over $1 billion. And then when the public found out that it wasn't AI, the evaluation dropped in half, and allegedly now they're filing for bankruptcy. And I just find it so ironic that everyone's so fear-based around AI, and then we have a company that's providing a solution with real people, and now it's devalued because it was actually real people behind the scenes. And by the way, if you go to Not the Onion and you search AI companies, Not the Onion, thousands of articles. I mean, every month there's hundreds. And so there's a lot of these that pop up, and there seems to be a trend with AI companies and people behind the scenes. I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that either.
The Wizard of Oz popped up in my head immediately. And so I guess we're not in Kansas anymore.
We are not in Kansas anymore. No, no.
My first thought was, how did this AI pass the SOC 2 audit? Was my first question.
Huh. It's a really good question, Jackie, but you know what? The SOC 2 doesn't address how you market yourself. It just addresses security controls around the cloud.
Yeah. That's a marketing failure.
It's fraud. It's like completely fraud any way you look at it. You know, it's like artificial intelligence. Maybe we're not really as smart as we say we are. I mean, what does that really mean?
Yeah, maybe we're not. All right, so let's jump into some trends and let's get into some questions here. So one trend that we're finding, Suzanne, that's really interesting, all of the CISOs and security leaders that we've been interviewing tend to have varying stories, varying backgrounds, but they all have a couple of solid things in common. And the biggest one for us is that they're very purpose-driven and that typically that purpose isn't about them. And so we find that the best CISOs out there are driven by purpose and they lead with purpose. And so we would love to understand what your purpose is, your guiding principles, or kind of a couple of things that drive you and kind of have been your guiding principles throughout your career.
Yeah. Customers, like first and foremost. And it's actually a lot of the reason I took the job at my current company, because I felt like we were very aligned on that. And when I say customers, it's not just like who we sell to, it's also my internal customers. And it can be even my team sometimes when they're relying on me for something. It's how do I figure out what they need, what they want, and deliver that? The second thing is impact. I've always been looking for, I was always the person that took on the projects that nobody else wanted because they had either failed or it was like too risky. And I was like, bring it on. I think that's going to be really fun. And then I think one of my guiding principles has always been to try to leave the person that I'm meeting with or working with better off than before they met me in some way. And whenever I'm not successful at that, it hurts. And I try to learn from that.
I love that.
Just personally, when the people you care about, the people you're leading, the people that you are trying to raise up, and when they're not happy or they're having a hard time and they can't get through a project, that's disheartening to you as a leader, for sure. And that's a hard one. I love that. I think that also comes back to the power of connection, right? Are you connecting with your team? Are you connecting with your stakeholders? Are you connecting with your customers? My life mantra has always been only good mojo in my dojo.
I love that.
Bring the sunshine, bring the happiness. Where I'm going to have my bad days, do not get me wrong. Yeah. I'm no perfect sunshiny angel, but I believe in that power of connection, because connection builds trust. Trust breeds real collaboration, and that's when the impact that you spoke of actually comes to fruition. I would love to hear your thoughts on connections in the space and how that's helped you along the way.
The most fun that I have in any given day is when you just create and do something amazing with other people. It's like, and we get to say, look at this amazing thing we've created. And I mean, it's like our baby, right? And we can go, we created a baby. It's great. Yes. Yeah. And I think when we talk about connection, you know, when I see like so many missed connections are mostly because people aren't listening. Or they're so focused on what they want, and they haven't really thought through and said, okay, what is it that this person's objectives are, you know, or what is it that like their constraints? And I see that a lot in the security field. And it's a lot of times why security professionals get yelled at. It's like, you just want to implement security and you don't care about the fact that I have a product roadmap that's a mile long. And so listening kind of helps you figure out, is there a path forward here or not? And what could that be? Is there a way to make this a joint win? And so I think that's a lot of what breeds the trust.
I love the joint win. That to me, I've had a tendency over my career to work on Jackie Island. I know what I'm doing. It'll be faster if I just do it. That doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help my customer. It doesn't help me. It doesn't help my team grow. It doesn't help any connections, because I'm not connecting with anybody other than myself. So it's been such a giant switch over the past 7 years of just let me go ahead and down. Let me just do it because I know it's going to get done right. We all suffer from it. I see a smile on your face that says, I've been there in my career before as well. Holy. But once I switched that and said, no, the power of a team, the power of people, it changed my whole thought process on success and how to get there together. And oftentimes, when you're working on Jackie Island or you're working on Suzanne Island, there's a good chance that Jackie and Suzanne are working on something similar that is going to impact the other one. So by the time we get off our islands and actually speak to each other, we've done double the work. I've stepped on your toes, you've stepped on mine. So for me, that collaboration, it streamlines your work. You're probably working towards common goals anyway. Do you have any stories that resonate with that?
Yeah. So what came to mind when you were talking about that was, you know, the feedback I got, there's a point where like every leader has been an amazing individual contributor at some point, right? And making that switch into leadership is one of the most difficult things. And I got that feedback of, hey, you're at that point in your career where you have to learn how to create impact through other people. It's not yourself. And that was a hard one for sure. The thing that came to mind for me is I think, you know, individual contributors, when we're all really good and the thinking that, oh, I can do this much faster myself, there's an arrogance to it, right? And yeah, and there's a, and in certain ways, that's good. Like it's a self-confidence of, you know I'm good, I can do this. And so I had a team, this was earlier in my career when I was working at Morgan Stanley. And I was working my butt off, like 14, 16 hour days. And I was convinced that if I went somewhere that everything was going to fall apart. And so I went on vacation for a week because like at banks, you have to go on vacation. That's part of the way that they would catch fraud in those days. And I went somewhere where I could, and that was before we had remote desktop and you know I couldn't call in and the like. I came back and my team had actually been a lot more productive. And I was like, huh. This is really interesting. And so then I started to pay attention to like truly what my leadership style was, what my impact was, and really broke down that arrogance in a way. So
I love that. I had a very recent one of those aha moments. I took PTO, which yay, Jackie, right? Took a week off, went to visit mom out in Georgia. My second in command was like, I got you. And I knew he did. And then the very next week, Tim and I are at a conference. So Matt, you've another week. You've got this, right? You're going to be tired. I can promise you're going to be tired, but you're going to crush it. Third week, well, Matt and I were supposed to go on site together. I had a family emergency. I couldn't go. He handled the whole thing mid-air, changing slides, changing talking points. The inner control freak in me, right? All of the things were completely gone because my ability to delegate and him be successful, delegation has been a horrible, horrible part of my career. You said it. I made a baby. I'm going to watch his baby grow. Nobody else is going to babysit my baby. This is my baby. But having somebody else take over, not just for a day, not just for a meeting, but for multiple weeks in a row and thrive and I can come back fully great. Nothing terrible on the table. I learned that being able to delegate is a flex on how good your team is and the supportive team that you created. And to me, that was huge. That was just last week. Delegation's been a problem with me for a real long time. So this was my, oh my gosh, it's actually a flex. I'm not needed every single meeting. I'm not needed every single moment. At what point in your career did that hit you? Because it's taken me 25 years to finally get to that point. I would love to hear from you.
I think it's always a constant struggle, right? Like, so the Morgan Stanley story I told you was about 20 years ago, right? And that was actually also about the same time that I got leadership coaching around, it was called delegating authority. Because I used to think that delegating tasks was just what you did, right? You said, go do that. But this was really different. It's about how do you help people be successful? Like what kind of authority do they actually need beyond just the knowledge and the understanding of the task? And like nobody's perfect at it all the time. And there's always like you have to flex your style in ways that are incredibly uncomfortable. And sometimes I do it really well. Sometimes I suck at it. It's just the way the world works. Yeah.
What I love that I heard there, Suzanne and Jackie, is that it's a skill that needs to be learned and taught and nurtured. And it's not just something that, oh, I'm a leader now. I have this skill. I can start delegating, right? Like it's an actual skill set. And if the three of us are talking about it, obviously it's a concern. And there's a lot of people that have these same issues. And so, but the fact that it's a skill, and I love, Suzanne, that you recognize it. You said there was a moment in my career that I was like, I got to get this skill set if I'm going to be effective. But the point is that it's a skill. It's not something that you just pick up and someone either had to teach it to you or you had to proactively seek out that skill set in order to grow it.
Yeah. I would also add on this, like part of my journey as a leader was also, I firmly believe that people rise to challenges, right? So like a lot of leaders don't set expectations higher. And so an example was like, we had a guy on my team, he'd been here for a couple of years and he was performing okay, right? And we talked about it internally and I was like, well, why don't we just tell him he's accountable for the program? Like you're truly accountable for that. And he rose to that challenge. And once he had that ownership, it was amazing what this guy did. And then he became a top performer. And I was like, this is amazing, right? But there's also a downside to that because I got feedback. God, this was like 10 years ago or something. My manager looked at me. He's like, you do realize that you set people up to fail. I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? He's like, yeah, you set these expectations really high and you wait until they fail and then you save them. And I was like, oh, crap, you're right. Because not everybody is gonna reach that apex or they need some help getting there. And so there's again, it's a learned skill. And as a manager, you've got to give yourself some grace, firstly. Nobody's perfect at it. And there's going to be people that thrive under you and think you're the best manager. Like, I mean, these skills that I've learned, I mean, I still have people that I managed 20 or 30 years ago now. Yeah, I'm really old. Like all the things. That think I'm like the best leader they ever had. Yeah, and that was before I'd learned some of these skills. I've got people that think I'm the worst leader they've ever had. And honestly, it probably was for them. So
it's a hard balance. Yeah. It's a hard balance because throughout my career, everything you're saying really resonates here right now.
I think the point is, it's like we do the best we can. We learn as much as we can. Guiding principle of try to make people better off. And when you fail at it, figure out what you learned and do better.
A lot of leaders have told me over my career, you need to shift your expectations because not everybody is going to have the same expectations of themselves as you do of yourself. And for the first 5, 10, 15, maybe years of my career, I was like, well, no, they should just do better. They should just do better. And then I had a leader who was like, all right, this has to stop right now because you're making yourself crazier than you already are with these expectations of everybody else. I'm smart enough to know that a junior and a senior are going to have vastly different things. But at a junior level, I still have high expectations of what they can do. So I think you and I are, again, in the very same boat. Maybe we set expectations too high and maybe that's a problem. But the people can't say that I've had anybody who hasn't put in all of the effort. Not everybody's going to be successful, and that's okay. Again, we can get into this at any point. We all have failures in our career. And one of my favorite things about failures is how much you learn from those failures, which I think is a wonderful topic. And I'm sure in your illustrious career, you have one or two potential failures that you can reminisce on. What did you get from that? What did you learn? And how did that help shape who you are as a leader?
So I've had a lot of failures, actually, in small and large ways. And it's actually my favorite interview question when I interview somebody is I ask them for a failure. And if they don't have one, it's an immediate, very, very negative viewpoint because I want them to have thought about it. So I'm trying to think which ones I can actually talk about publicly, by the way. When I was probably 10 or 15 years ago, I was put on as a project manager on an ERP implementation. And I'd never done an ERP implementation. And I sold myself on the fact that I got things done and I'd managed really large projects before, but I didn't even know what an ERP was. Like, I had to go look that up. And then, you know, I'm sitting with, you know, a bunch of the people in there or the project team. They're starting to talk about like COAs. And I'm thinking, is that like some sort of dead on arrival thing? Or what is that? It's chart of accounts. I'm like, I didn't know anything. And it was too much too fast for me. And in an area that, frankly, I wasn't that interested in. And I got fired off the project, rightly so. And huge hit to my confidence in many ways. But the benefit of it was I did spend 2 weeks. I took 2 weeks off and went to Hawaii with my now husband and daughter. And we had a great time. And I swam with the manta rays and did a great thing. You know, but I think you talk about the things that I learned there. I've always been pretty, very candid about what I've done and where I've been and like my start in security. I literally told the guy who was hiring me, like, you know, I know nothing about security and haven't worked for a tech company, right? But at the same time, it's also knowing what do I want to take on and what do I need and asking for what I need, not just believing that this can be, it's going to be okay. Because like, could I have been as successful at that? Yeah, probably. But I would have needed a lot of support and a lot of coaching. And I didn't ask for it.
And there was no joy in it because it wasn't something that truly interested you. We put forth the effort, even in positions that we don't enjoy. And again, that comes back to joy and authenticity. And if you are truly not interested in your job, I was going to say you're going to dial it in. I don't think we're dialing in kind of people. We're still going to give it our all. But the energy and the excitement and the let's get the group hooing and hawing and having like a good project time is not going to happen in those moments at all.
And I think too, one of the things that I see a lot is that sometimes there's this expectation, particularly if you're a high performer, that you're just supposed to get it. You're just supposed to know what to do.
Well, of course.
You know, and there's also, I hear this a lot with junior employees about, well, we can't ask for what we need because we're not going to get it, or we're going to get, you know, there's going to be a problem if we ask. And that's one of the things I've drilled into my team is ask for what you want. And you're going to love this. I've also, my children, by the way, are really good at this because I've told them this too. They're 8 and 14 girls. My 14-year-old girl, she asks for everything she wants. And, you know, I've told her, I was like, why are you asking for this? She just looks at me. She said, you told me to. So there's pride, and it's like, yeah, I did, and I'm really proud of you. And, oh, it's terrible.
The other day, my 9-year-old is making a case. He wants the new Nintendo device.
Yeah, totally.
He's making his case. We're in the car, and he's like, Dad, the benefit to you is this. And I just look back, and he goes,
so cool.
And he goes, first and foremost, your son's going to be happy. Second, so he starts laying out all of these benefits that were very benefit-centric to me. And I look back, and I'm like, man, I could really want to buy this for you right now because of the way you said it, right? So our kids are picking up what we're putting down, Suzanne. They really are.
We got a new stable leader out there in the universe coming our way. A little York is coming for all of us. That's awesome. I've heard you say a lot of things about, oh, early in my career and this, that, and the other. My favorite thing. Let's get on your origin story. How did you get into IT? How did that move into cyber? How did that go through leadership?
So I was a poli-sci major and I got a master's in public administration. I thought I was going to go into government and save the world. And then I got my student loan debt repayment schedule. So that was out the window. And I ended up in process reengineering and benchmarking for a utility consulting company. And then I ended up at Morgan Stanley in their project management group. And again, this was a situation where in the interview, it's like, I don't know anything about technology and I don't know anything about finance or financial services. And they said, you'll learn it. Yeah. And I worked there. I worked at Morgan Stanley for 8 years. They were an incredibly good company, very supportive, and I had amazing opportunities. I ended up implementing Sarbanes-Oxley in year one. And there was a heavy technical component to that, obviously. Then went on from there to be the business owner or the product owner for some IT projects. But then 2008 came along, financial crisis, I was laid off. And which, by the way, is a huge rejection. Like, even if it makes sense, it's like, I don't care who you are. You're just like, but I'm great. How can you not see that I'm great? But I survived it. And yeah. And I, by the way, this is like something another manager told me once. He's like, rethink what a good outcome looks like here, right? And so I've always remembered that. And we ended up in Seattle. And my project management consulting company I was working with said, hey, we've got an opening at Point B, or sorry, that's the consulting firm, Microsoft, for a interim security manager. Funny thing about security. Yeah, but you've got the risks and controls. And they said they want that. And I was like, all right. It turned out it was the Global Foundation Services right as they were moving into the cloud. Again, great interview, really gelled with the manager. He later hired me full time. And again, I was going through this. And I'm like, I know he's going to hire me. And I need to make sure he knows. I don't know anything about security and have never worked at a tech company. But that's how I got into security. That's my origin story.
I love that. All those stories come back to me. What I'm hearing is hire the person, not the resume. The resume says, I can do these great things. I'm successful in my past. It may not be aligned directly to what my new role is, but the person, the energy, the want, the craving to learn, the craving to be great, that's who you hire, right? You've got the soft skills. You've got the brains. The brains may not be directly linked to the new job, but if you've shown throughout your career that you are clearly willing to learn, willing to lead, willing to do all of the things. So to me, not that you don't have a great resume, but it's the personality.
Yeah.
Again, coming back to that human element, it's the person, and that's great.
I love that you're challenged early in your career with things that you didn't understand and that you were willing to say, like from day one, I don't know this, but I'm willing to try and put effort into it. And I feel like just based on what you said about how you give tasks to your employees, I think there's probably a correlation there. Is there a connection with the way you were brought up early and the way that you lead and coach today?
Oh, wow. I blame my mother. I was joking about that. I think both my parents were very much into figure it out, right? Like there was a lot of problem solving early on. There was a lot of, if you want it, you figure out how to go get it. And like my dad tells this story, or my mom and dad told this story about how I talked them into giving me a $350 monthly allowance when I was like 13 or 14, because I broke down a budget, same thing that Tim, your son, did. I knew what was important to them. I knew how to sell it to them. And I broke down the budget of why I needed these things, what I was going to pay for and how it was all going to work. And so they were like, okay. When I started driving, my mom, so I had a 2 a.m. curfew. Please don't tell my 14-year-old this when I was 15, because I had explained to my parents exactly what we were doing, where we were going, and who I was going to be with, and why the timing made it such that I had to be home at 2 a.m. to be the most safe. And then when I started driving, my mom wanted to reduce the curfew to midnight because she worried about me. And which now I understand that at that point in time, I had no empathy for her.
Lots of how dare you. All right.
Completely. God, I was like queen of the eye rolls. Then it was just logic. It was like, look, if you reduce my curfew, then I'm going to have to take a ride and I'm not going to be able to drive other people. And wouldn't you be more comfortable with me driving than me being in a car with a drunk boy?
So one thing that I love very much is mentoring and mentorship. I'm gonna guess you might have had a few good mentors in your career. I'd love to hear about things that they have given you to be the power to be who you are today, and what those relationships look like and how they came. Was it just a random, wow, you've been appointed to John. Okay, let's make it work. Or did you seek out, or did somebody seek you out? I would love to hear again how people influenced you.
So I want to start actually with something. When I was at Morgan Stanley, I went to this women's financial conference. And the thing I remember about this the most was this managing director at a bank said, you have to be someone that people want to help. And then you need to ask for help and you need to take it when it's offered. Right. And now I don't think I did that as well all the time as I could have, but I've always remembered that. And so what that means is that when a lot of my mentors have just been random people that I just got along with and very informal, and I'd just start talking to them, I'd start asking them questions, and I would learn from them. And sometimes I didn't even know I was learning from them. Some of my mentors were when I had very specific challenges, I would randomly call it people that I thought could help me. I would say, I have a problem. I have this problem. I need your help. Can you help me? And they would. And then it wasn't necessarily a formal mentoring relationship where we met every week or every month. They would just be there for me when I needed them. But I have had so many mentors, but like two pieces of advice that I've gotten over the years that I think have been most pivotal. One was that a mentor said, you're ready to be a CISO. Okay. At that point in time, I hadn't even had that on my career path. Like I thought I had tapped out in my career. I was a senior director and I thought that's as far as I was going to get to go. And at that point, I was like, really? And we talked about what that really meant. And he was like, yeah, you need to really think about why you would want to be a CISO. And you need to think about what that means and how to go after it. And once that idea is planted in your head, you can't let it go. It's like, you can't let I couldn't stay a senior director. And I was so grateful to him for that. And then another mentor, I got promoted to an executive director at Morgan Stanley. I was a very young executive director and my career looked very bright. Got a huge bonus that year. Everything was going great. And she told me, she said, make sure you pay attention to the rest of your life, your relationships with your family. If you want kids, I didn't have kids at that point. If you want kids, your friendship, she said, because the company is here for you right now, but there's going to be a point where it's not. And I've shared that advice all over the place because, you know, I meet women all the time who are like, oh, my career is too demanding. I want kids, but I just can't. And I'm like, oh no, you have to figure this out. It's like, believe in yourself that you'll figure it out because your job isn't always going to be there for you.
That resonates with me. I was told my whole career, early career, if you ask questions, you'll seem like you're unskilled and people aren't going to trust you. And that was pre-consulting. That was corporate America. You better know how to do your job and just do it and be great, right? I got into consulting and like you, I've never been a consultant. I enjoy connecting with people. I love talking to people. I love discovery sessions. I love talking identity. I didn't realize that was consulting. Consulting was this big, scary word out in the universe. Turns out I've been consulting since I could walk. I didn't know that. It took a while. But one of my very first customers, when I started consulting, I had no idea what they were talking about. It was an industry I had never seen. And I had to get over my fear of asking what I assumed were stupid questions. Because if I'm giving them a path forward, if I'm roadmapping their future and I don't understand a very specific part of their industry, and I ask 6 weeks later, all that trust is out the window. So it took me getting over my own fear and my own years of leadership and management telling me, don't ask questions, to find out that asking questions is one of the greatest skills such that you can have. And that is something that I preach to my team now. Ask questions, ask often, do not feel embarrassed about asking because it's going to show your foresight, your wanting to learn, that craving to understand. And again, the more you understand, the more you connect, the more you trust, the more collaborative everybody gets. I wish I had somebody early in my career who would have given me that advice because it's something that I struggled with until 3 years ago. The first 15 years, I could have been on a completely different trajectory if I would have just asked some questions.
And there's something really important that we want that I would love to call out here. So there's three levers that are pulled in the mentor relationship, right? Like you're either helping someone, so you're asking for help, you're offering help. But what you pointed out, Suzanne, that's really important is to receive help. If someone offers you help, to accept it and receive it is a skill set in and of itself, right? To receive that help. And I want to dig into that because I'm assuming there's times when someone offered you help and you're like, I don't need this. Or you think about it and you go, maybe I do need some help. And so I don't know if you have an example or a time whether you offered help and someone didn't receive it or they did in a way or vice versa. And then you were part of that situation.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about is when you seek out mentors, they're not always right. Like part of the skill with mentorship is to be able to evaluate what's going to work for you and the like. And so I'll give you an example. So I'd been at Morgan Stanley for a year and they were promoting me to a vice president. And actually there's two stories related to this. And the first story is I went home and I told my husband that I didn't think I was ready for it. And he started laughing so hard, he had to leave the room. And he came to pass it. 15 minutes later, he said, there's not a man in the world that would ever think that way. He said, if they think you're ready, and go. And so I've always remembered that, because I do find I have times in my life where I feel like, oh my God, am I ready for this? And I'm like, okay, well, somebody else thinks I'm ready, or, you know, I'm going to do my best. Like, I'm going to add value wherever I can. But back to the advice that you get. So this was actually my manager at the time. He had told me that my internal client had really pushed this. And there's like a 6-month period when they tell you that you're going to get promoted to when you do. And it's not a for sure thing. You're just being put up for promotion. And I said, what do you think I should do between that period of time to like really cement my promotion, right? And he said, well, you know how in meetings where, you know, talk a lot and you give your opinion? I'm like, yeah. He said, stop doing that. Just be quiet. Don't take risks. And I was really confused. And I was like, huh. Because it didn't resonate really well with me, right? And so I went and I talked to another mentor of mine at the company. And I told him this story, and he rolled his eyes and he said, that's the worst advice anybody could ever give you. You're being put up for promotion because of exactly what you do. Keep doing it. So I just want everybody out there who's listening to realize that if you think you're getting bad advice, you are. And go validate and go figure it out.
You think you're getting bad advice, you are.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's like, we've got a bullshit meter in our head.
So this back real quickly to live music or to music. I'm not a musician, but when a musician is singing and they're out of tune, I can pick up on that, right? And I feel like that's probably what you had. You had this gut feel where you're like, I don't know about that advice. Like, as a human, we pick up on that. Like, I can't sing like the guy on the stage or the gal on the stage, but I know when they're out of tune or when they're in tune, right? And so we feel it. And I think that's similar, where you got to check your gut sometimes. And we're such a data-driven group of people, especially with what we do in tech and in security. Sometimes your gut is the most important indicator of that, right?
Yeah, you'd ask the question about if I've ever given advice that people don't take or the like. And the answer is yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's somebody very early on told me, when the student is ready, the master will appear. One of the biggest mistakes in like coaching, mentorship, and leading is that we try too hard. It's like we believe that we can change somebody or that we can help them. But if they're not willing or ready to take that advice, and I've had a couple of employees over the years where what I've realized my mistake was I tried too hard. And they weren't, like, there was either the way I was trying to give the feedback, even though my intentions were good, it was making them shut down. And if they've shut down, stop. Yeah. You have to stop. And there were times when I'm sure and I know that people were giving me advice and I just wasn't ready to hear it. But there's also times where I remember the advice 10 years later and I'm like, oh, now I'm ready. And being a beginner learner is hard, especially the more and more senior that you get. But it's when I look at, you talked about hiring the person, I look for that. I want people that are evaluating, changing all the time. But it is a hard skill and you have to constantly cultivate it.
Those soft skills, man. It's not a learn it once. It's learn it and recheck yourself constantly.
So we're doing career pathing on my team right now. And actually, one of my direct reports said, I don't want to call them soft skills because it diminishes how important they are. So we've actually decided to call them effectiveness skills.
Oh, okay. We're going to bravo that all around. I do like that. I'm going to have to change a bunch of slides. If that's not peak Jackie, you're right there going, okay, how many slides and presentations do I have the word soft skills on? I would love to switch to one of my favorite topics ever. Challenging stakeholders. I know in my space, in identity and in cyber and security as a full, we touch every part of the business. We have to have those relationships with everybody, whether we like it or they like it or not. We impact you and you impact us. I think a big thing, big challenge in this industry is getting all your stakeholders to, one, come to the table and then talk to each other and work towards common goals. I have, as an advisor, as a consultant, I'd run across a grumpy goose or two in my day. I would love to hear your stories, your secret sauce on how to get those grumpy gooses to the table, engaged, and what comes from that once you get them. Would love to hear your thought on that.
So I actually love grumpy gooses the most. And the reasoning for that is if they're being grumpy, it means they're willing to talk to you about what's wrong. Okay, which is so much better. Like, you can actually action what's wrong. You can't action people that just won't talk to you or just like, yeah, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. And those are the passive aggressive ones that, you know, it's harder. But the grumpy ones, firstly, you engage. Like, I had a client at Microsoft when I started there. You know, I was a contractor in this team and everyone said, I'm not going to tell you his name. He's still my friend, actually. But they're like, he's so difficult to work with and he's always complaining and, you know, we don't like him. And so I took him to lunch.
Yeah, of course.
I just took him out to lunch and I was like, okay, what's the problem? And I was I'm a very direct person. I'm like, what's the problem? It's like, you seem unhappy. Let's talk about it. And come to find out, all he needed was a project plan. So I gave him a project plan and then he started becoming super helpful.
I found that they just need to be heard. Oftentimes, they say, this is a problem, this is a problem, leadership, I need this, help, 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 and they don't feel heard. And that's when the shutdown starts, and that's when the working on Jackie Island starts, and then all of a sudden, you're not a part of a team anymore, and then you're even more disconnected. I agree with you 100%. The grumpy geese are my favorite. Once you crack that outer shell and you understand why they're not engaged, why they're not grumpy, again, is it you're not heard? Is it your ideas are being shot down? Did somebody else take credit for your work? There's a million reasons why people sit down and be grumpy. One of my first clients I ever had in consulting, there was a gentleman, we were in a workshop doing discovery. He had his back turned to me, his arms crossed the entire time, and he didn't want to engage at all. And I said, oh, that's my guy. That's my guy. First break possible. Go talk to him. He was the Pam guy. His thoughts didn't matter. Pam was this was 15 years ago. Pam was a secondary thought, right? All of the things. And I made it really important in my next sessions to say, hey, guys, Pam is critical. Pam is going to make or break your program. Pam, chair turns around, arms come down. He is excited. And this is where I coined the term grumpy goose to groupie, because once you turn them from grumpy goose, they will be your biggest advocate. They will be your biggest cheerleader. And they're doing half your work now. They're doing half your work. You don't have to do anything. And it's because you take that time to see the guy in the room or the gal in the room who's completely disengaged. And again, as a woman, I can give 1,000 stories on when I've been talked over, when my idea has been taken, when that's a stupid idea, Jackie, why would you even talk about that? Of course you're going to shut down. So those are the people that I gravitate to. And as my husband jokes all the time, every time I come home from someplace, well, how many new best friends do you have? And I was like, well, I've got Bob the Pam guy. And it just, I mean, it's an often avoided person in the room because, oh gosh, I don't want to interact with somebody who's negative. But why are they negative? Let's get to that root cause. And for me, that's how you engage your stakeholders and turn them, again, into your biggest cheerleader. It's one of the greatest skills that I think is missing out there.
I think there's, as a leader though, too, it's also not just like I can turn anybody, you know, into an advocate, right? But you have to turn them for the team too. And like, we had a situation relatively recently where we were starting to just hear more negativity from one of our partner teams than we'd heard. And I was starting to hear my team griping and complaining about them. And so I called it. I said, look, something's wrong. And I said, you guys can keep griping and complaining. I said, that's easy, but is it going to solve anything? And they thought about it and they're like, no, actually, it's really not. I said, so let's go figure out what the problem is. And this was like something it had to do with, they were complaining about tickets that were going through and they weren't being actioned the way that they should be and there were mistakes being made. And I said, look, this is probably a role issue or a process issue. Maybe the procedure isn't correct. Let's go figure it out because I guarantee you that person isn't any happier than you are, right? And they're probably griping about you too. And we really talked about it as a team that it's on us to not just go into the complaining, griping mode.
I think there's a place for everybody. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to be sunshine and rainbows all day. Even I have my storm cloud days, but it's contagious in a bad way.
That's totally contagious.
And it's oftentimes not the technology. Okay, I'm going to go into my little spiel, as I always do. It's often not the technology. It's usually the people in the process that need to be realigned. Your technology is only going to do what your processes are telling it to do. And your processes are only going to do what the people who understand the back end are implementing those processes. So oftentimes we can gripe about this, that, and the other. It usually is fixed with a very simple conversation. And I think we are, not that I love to pick up my phone and call anybody, but I think that is one thing that we don't do well as a society right now. Is human connection. That word's come up a couple times on this call already, but it's, again, it's about the people, it's about the human connection. COVID lockdown, I think, killed a lot of our spirit. I was a road warrior pre-COVID. My whole identity was a road warrior, was a consultant, was being outside and connecting with people. And then it's like, you get to stay in the same room for 12 hours a day and look out the same window and, oh, but you can't talk to people and you can't see people and all the dogs that you see, you can't go and pet them anymore. COVID lockdown stole my identity and it's taken a really long time to get it back. And again, it comes back to, I need that human connection. It's what, it literally powers me. And it's so important. It's so important. And again, the contagiousness of the negativity on the opposite side, I think you and I are very similar here, the contagiousness of positivity. Tim and I had a very interesting conversation yesterday about gratitude, and I'm thankful for him, he's thankful for me, and we tell each other that often because it's important. I would love to hear your thoughts on spreading positivity, and granted, we, like I said, we can't all be sunshine and rainbows, but as a leader, I think it's very important to have that positivity and have that for your team. I would, again, love to hear your stories, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I literally wrote an email yesterday, which I ended with, I am grateful for the collaboration that we have here. And I'm sure, you know, like the North Korean threat actors that are getting hired in as IT people, we haven't had that at my company yet, but it's so pervasive across, you know, CISOs that I talk to. Somebody on my team had gone to a webinar that was really good, summed up all the issues, and I had sent it off to my IT team, my procurement team, my talent acquisition team, including the head of HR, and, you know, just said, hey, look, there's a lot of really pragmatic things in here. I think we're doing these, you know, however, can I ask each of you to please, you know, read this? And please watch the webinar. And I was like, and one of the things they talked about in the webinar is that HR is a blocker or IT is a blocker or procurement is a blocker. And I'm like, I'm so grateful for all of you that we are working together, you know, to ensure that our company is safe. And I think it is really important because people, when they feel like they're being attacked, you know, they respond like that. And I think as security professionals, it can come so quickly like that. When I started at my company, one of the divisions had a SOC issue, you know, and we had a SOC finding. It didn't lead to a qualified opinion, but it was an exception, you know, and the like, and they were embarrassed. And, you know, I was told by lots of people, oh, you know, they're not going to respond and they're going to be really upset about it. You know, and I just went and I had a chat with them and I was like, okay, how can we help? You know, what can we do here? And this was an executive who reported to the CEO, and you know, they told everyone, including my boss, that they were like, you know, I didn't feel attacked. I felt like they were grateful for the help and the connection and the, hey, we're in this together.
I'm going to say I love that again, because I do love that, because a huge part of my job as a strategic advisory is, again, let's get all those stakeholders to the table and let's have them have a voice. We all have a voice, and our voices need to be heard, or else we're just implementing what we need to implement and not thinking about the fuller picture. So having good stakeholders who are appreciated and appreciative of you, it's, to me, it's the end all be all, because none of us can do this alone.
It's what's your love language, right? Yeah. Like, you know, everybody's got like work love languages, and, you know, it's not just languages between, you know, your, and it's not just languages between your spouse, right? It's like, you know, some people really want acts of service. They want you to do something for them. And that's how they know that you're on their side. Other people want the words of affirmation, and it's not like they want, they need this. And, you know, it's not a heavy lift. It's like, it's just figuring it out.
You both have mentioned gratitude, and being part of being a leader is someone who can show gratitude. And what's really interesting about gratitude is when an act of gratitude happens, three people or three different groups receive happiness. And so I learned this from Sean Anchor. He did the TED Talk, Happiness Advantage. He wrote a book. He's the happiness expert at Harvard. And he's one of the people that I love to follow. But anyway, he talks about this and he says, look, when an act of kindness or an act of gratitude happens, the person who gives the gratitude is fulfilled and grows and learns and has that feeling. The person who receives the gratitude is also fulfilled and learns, but everybody around you that witness it get that same feeling. And so it's like taking care of somebody. Now it's 3x the effort of happiness and elevation of the group, as opposed to the other way. If you do an act of, if you're calling someone out publicly, the three people receive negativity, you have three levers there. And so I love gratitude because of that. It's a force multiplier and it makes everybody feel better. And so I think that's a good note to finish on. And Simon Sinek is my other guiding star. I love Simon Sinek, especially, you know, finding your why and finding your purpose, and leading by purpose is one of the things that he focuses on. And on his last podcast, he had a guest, Susie Welsh, come on. And Susie Welsh teaches a course, I can't remember the university, I've watched so many of these, but she teaches a course at a university about finding your purpose. And she breaks it down to three things. The three indicators of success within your purpose are people, ideas, and execution. It's her pie model. And so the very best leaders surround themselves with the very best people. They have the best ideas, or they cultivate the best ideas. And finally, they execute with the group. They don't do it alone. They execute with the group around them. So on that note, I would like to thank you, Suzanne, for joining our podcast. You are a fantastic guest. We would love to have you back on in the future.
This was a wonderful, easy conversation. So honored to have you as my first guest on the podcast. And this was great. And thank you so much for all of your insight. It was very fun. And hopefully we'll have you back, and looking forward to connecting with you and continue this chat offline.
Likewise. And thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thank you, Jackie, for your participation. We will sign off. This is Authenticate This. Thank you for joining us in this episode of Authenticate This, the Cybersecurity Leadership Podcast. Check out the show notes for links and resources mentioned in today's shows. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss on any future episodes.